My favorite speaker in all of the information. Every age has its metaphor for the world, and this is kind of a commonplace observation. In Aristotle's day, the world was an organism, and everything had its sort of part that worked together. And in Newton's day, the world was a mechanism, was a clockwork. And today, sort of inevitably, we think of the world as a network, as sort of the internet. So we've got pieces of the world, subsystems of the world, and they interact with each other. They interact with each other and send each other messages. Especially for those of us who've been thinking about the physics of information for some time, this is sort of how we view the world. What I would like to ask. Is a big question, which I will not completely answer, but I'll say a few things about it. And that is, if this network that is the world, this set of interacting subsystems all talk to each other, if this is a quantum mechanical system, then what are kind of the basic rules that govern how systems exchange information by interacting with each other? And I think that that's a kind of a central sort of question if you're trying to understand the quantum world. So I figured I could smuggle it into this meeting. But also, it's all along been one of the central questions in understanding basic quantum mechanical physics. So to illustrate that, let me talk about the sort of thing you've seen a lot so far. I think let's think about an interferometer. Here's a capsule or mirror, and it has some beam of light that comes in here, and it splits into two, and they come over here, and they go back through a second capsule or mirror, and then we have some detectors. Here's a detector. Okay, a little photo multiplier through there, and then we can adjust the phase relation between the two beams in our interferometer by maybe we have a little thin wedge of glass that we can move back and forth and adjust the phase relationship between the two beams, and we can send photons to the interferometer one at a time, and we can see interference in the probabilities of the photon arriving at this detector or this detector. And so the maximum probability that a photon arrives at this detector in some reasonable idealized situation, but it is one. It can be as big as one. And if I adjust the phase relationship a little bit differently, this little phase relationship alpha, the minimum probability can be as low as zero. And the fact that just by varying the phase relationship between two, I can make them one or zero, that's constructive and destructive interference between the two possible paths for the photon. But now suppose that I introduce another element of the photon. This is all completely familiar to you, but indulge me anyway. Suppose I introduce another piece of the photon. Another piece of the interferometer. These two photon states we might call the upper beam and the lower beam. And now let's suppose I introduce an atom that's going to get really close to the beam here and is going to have its state be affected by the passage of the photon. We're going to do this in this great non-demolition way that would be good if we could do it, but we can't, but we're going to pretend we can. So this thing starts out in the state zero, and it interacts here with the light field, and the net result is something like this. Let me erase the universe here. The net result is something like this. If you start out with the light in the upper beam and the atom in its ground state zero, that evolves to be the same thing. The photon doesn't jump to a different beam, and the atom doesn't become excited. But if the photon is in the lower beam, and the atom starts out in its ground state, then you have some different state for the atom afterwards. And of course, in this interferometer, after the light passes through this half-silver mirror, I'll have a superposition of the two beams. And so I'll start out with 1 over the square root of 2 times the sum of these guys. Oh, well, that's the easy thing. And that evolves, obviously, into this thing that will just take me a moment to write down. Let me get my coffee. Right, okay, so there's this. Now, when this state, which is an entangled state, perhaps, depending on what size, which is an entangled state of the atom and the photon, when this state arrives at the second half-silver mirror, you won't necessarily get what you got before. And indeed, what you find is, if you adjust this phase relationship, that the maximum probability that you'll get in any one of the detectors is 1/2 times 1 plus the magnitude of the inner product of the initial state of the atom and the state that that it goes into if the photon were in the lower beam. So this is 1/2 plus this amplitude, this magnitude of this amplitude, and the minimum is 1/2 1 minus this guy. Unless the state is basically the same as the initial state, you will have less strong constructive interference and less strong destructive interference. Indeed, if these are orthogonal states, you have no interference effects at all. The maximum probability and the minimum probability are just the same. You move this wedge of glass in and out, and you don't affect the probabilities at all. You have no interference at all. So the point is that inasmuch as this atom has sort of registered some information from the photon, it will take away the characteristic quantum effect of superposition. To say it a little bit differently, interference effects will remain while the system is informationally isolated. This is something we sometimes say, well, if the photon is isolated, then interference effects are seen, but if it's not isolated, maybe not. But in fact, the photon could and may, pass through big chunks of glass. It may not be a photon, maybe it's a charged particle, and there's an electric field that produces a potential difference between the two paths. All of those situations will still produce interference, all kinds of outside effects. The gravitational field of Saturn will produce some kind of interaction with the electromagnetic field here, but that's not the point. The point is that you'll see the interference effects when the outside world does not extract information about which path. And so the key idea here is that you get interference effects, you see the results of the superposition principle when the system is informationally isolated. So we might say that quantum mechanics is what happens when nobody is looking. So, the I suggest that's a good slogan for a t-shirt. If you need a t-shirt. I saw one this morning, but I think that... Okay. What I want to talk about is dynamics. I want to talk about how to describe quantum dynamics. I'm going to spend a good deal of time in the first hour simply describing the general framework for discussing quantum dynamics. It's been alluded to before several times this week, but we're going to try to do it right today. And then perhaps at the end of this hour, and perhaps only in the second hour, we'll pick up that description, and we'll use it to understand some things about information flow between quantum systems. So dynamics. If we have an informationally isolated system, if we have an informationally isolated system, then we have unitary dynamics. That is to say, an initial state vector evolves into a state vector in which I'm operating one by a unitary transformation. This is unitary. And if I have a density operator, if my initial state is described by some density operator, then the density operator evolves according to that. And this is kind of well understood. But if my system is open, if I have an open system that may be interacting with the outside world, I'm going to need a more general description. Yeah.
Informationally isolated and unable to influence or not influenced by the environment. It seems like information is one concept, and then, as you say, you have the gravitational field interactions from Saturn in theory some kind of interaction.
Right.
And in some sense, there is information being exchanged between those systems.
Is there?
For one definition.
You see, if you're in a situation where interference occurs, where you have this perfect interference pattern, then that can only happen under an extremely strong condition that nowhere in the universe is there a record of which path the photon took. That's a remarkable statement. That if you went out and examined Saturn, or you went out and examined the surrounding particle field, nowhere is there a record. Nowhere is it possible, even in principle, to determine which path it took. Now, this is very unlike the situation in classical physics, because in classical physics there is a gravitational attraction between Saturn and the photon, I guess, and whether the photon goes this way or that way, that will have a very tiny effect on the trajectory of Saturn. And by making an exceedingly precise measurement, perhaps you could use Saturn as a probe to determine which way the light went around the interferometer. But quantum mechanically, no. Saturn itself is a quantum mechanical object, presumably, and it turns out that any interaction it produces no effect, or so small an effect that this number is almost exactly one. Okay. So quantum mechanics is really asserting something really amazing here. But of course, to sort out what I mean by informationally isolated and sort out what I mean by these records, I'm going to have to build better machinery. And that's part of my point today, is to build better machinery. Sandy.
Yeah, so I think that, just to clarify, Saturn would have a very big influence on the photon.
Yes.
The same whether it goes on the up way or on the lower way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct. So it's not a question of being dynamically isolated, like you might do if you were doing some classical mechanics problem about deriving the conservation of momentum or something. No, it's the kind of isolation we're talking about is informational isolation. There could be quite a lot of of interaction, so long as a record was not made. Yes?
How do you make this mathematically precise? Or just express it mathematically? Because information is...
Allow me to spend the next couple of hours beginning the answer to that question. Okay. All right. So, if we have an open system, that is not informationally isolated, all kinds of things can happen. You can have pure states evolving into mixed states. You have mixed states evolving into pure states. You have all kinds of terrible things. In general, what you're going to have is some kind of map on density matrices. You're going to have a map on density operators. It's going to be something like this. Your state will evolve to a new state, which is some function of the old state. This is what you're going to have in general. And certainly, this unitary evolution is an example of this, but there are other things possible. And so the question is, what sort of maps are possible? What sort of generalized quantum evolutions are even conceivably possible in the universe? Would make sense as a map on states that was reasonable. Okay. So let me answer that question first. The first statement that I want to make is that E must be linear in the density operator. The argument for that is something like this. Like any argument where you derive a mathematical principle from physical consideration, there's probably a little bit of wiggle room in this. But let me continue and perhaps persuade you of this. I want to adopt an ensemble picture. That is to say, one of the ways I could arrive at a density operator is to have a big bucket of systems, and some of them are in one state, some of them are in another, and I draw out a system at random. So I have this ensemble, and I have some of them are in row 0, and some of them are in row 1, and the average state, the state I would assign to a random representative of this bucket is the state rho, which is some probability 0 for rho 0 plus some probability 1 rho 1. Now what do? I take the systems in my bucket, and for each of them, I apply this generalized dynamics. And I get a new bucket, and some of them are in E of row 0, and some of them are in E of row 1. And so the state, the density operator I would ascribe to a representative drawn manually from this bucket would be P0 times E row 0, because this is the fraction of the population that is in this state, plus P1, E of row 1. But that's going to have to be E of row. So that's going to have to be E of the linear combination of these density operators. That's going to be the linear combination of the image of these density operators. And so this is going to have to be a linear map. That's the argument. Okay. Linear map of density matrices, it sort of ignores probabilistic mixtures. Okay, 2. All right. We want to make sure that whenever we give this map an input state, a legitimate input state, that what comes out is a legitimate output state. That if this map takes a density operator as input, it had better give a density operator as output. And that gives us a couple of conditions. The first one is that E must be trace preserving, because the density operator going in is trace 1, and the density operator coming out had better also be trace 1. So the trace of E rho equals the trace rho. And I can extend that, because I have linearity, off of the space of density operators to all operators. And then finally, I've got something that will produce an operator, and that operator will be trace one. What else do I need for it to be a density operator? Positivity, right? So I'm going to say that the map E must be itself positive, by which I mean, so three, well, that's interesting. Okay, so that means that, E must be positive, by which I mean that if this operator is positive, then E of rho is positive. Okay, so I've concluded that for this to be a conceivable map on density operators, it should be linear, trace preserving, and positive. Now, here's the interesting thing. That's not enough. That categorization is not sufficient. There are maps that satisfy those conditions that are not conceivable as the evolutions of quantum systems, even open quantum systems in the vicinity of really weird stuff. Not possible. Why not? Well, this gets kind of interesting. Suppose there's another system nearby, a bystander system. It doesn't interact with our system. It's just there. So we have the system we were talking about, which we'll call system Q. That's our quantum system. We have this other bystander system, which we'll call R, because that's the letter right next to the Q. And Q, so this is kind of like one of those circuit diagrams that you've seen flash up on the screen, quantum circuits. Q evolves according to E. R doesn't do anything. It has trivial dynamics. It just evolves according to the identity. These are completely independent systems. Okay? This is certainly possible. It's certainly possible that there's another piece of the universe standing nearby or at some distance away even, that is not participating in the process that's happening to this, that has its own very trivial history. So that means that the whole system, RQ, evolves according to the operator I tensor E. Okay, and our requirement is that this map can also better be positive. Not simply that E is positive, but that this map is positive, because you could have some input system of the pair of input state of the pair of systems that could evolve according to this. So it had better be positive. And it turns out that that requirement is a stronger condition than the original requirement, just that E must be positive. The requirement that whenever I extend the system in this way, this map is a positive map, is a stronger condition than simply saying that E is positive. And so we get requirement number four, the most interesting of them, that E must be completely positive. By which I mean that any extension of the map in this way is positive. Yeah?
Should be completely trace preserving as well.
Well, it turns out that automatically follows because I can just take the traces kind of independently here. But the problem is, for positivity, is that not only can I feed in product states, which are automatically giving me positive outputs because of the positivity of E and the positivity of the activity, but I can also choose entangled input states. And the entangled input states can get you in trouble. So let me describe, just to make you feel good, let me describe an example of a positive map that's not completely positive, as a sort of a standard example. right here, but then I'll probably erase it later on. So we're going to talk about a qubit map. And I can represent the density operators of a qubit by the block sphere. Up here we have the density operator associated with the pure state 0. Down here we have the density operator associated with pure state 1. You guys have seen this. I know you've seen this before earlier this week. And there are various other. All pure states are on the surface. The mixed states are in the middle. Okay, so we've got a qubit here. And here's the map. Here's my map. What about, I called it T, but for no particular reason. T of 0, 0 is 1, 1. And T of 1, 1 is equal to 0, 0. And I better tell you some more, or else I haven't defined T. T of the operator 0, 1, which is not a density operator, but it is an operator, so I can feed it to my map. It's unchanged, and T of 1, 0 is also unchanged. And if you want to know what this does, this simply reflects the block sphere in the equatorial plane. It simply reflects the block sphere in the equatorial plane, like that. Okay? Now, it turns out that this map is not completely positive, although it is obviously positive because it maps the block sphere to the block sphere. Nothing goes outside of the block sphere and picks up negative eigenvalues. It's not completely positive because if I have two qubits, then the map I tensor T is not positive. If I feed this map an entangled input state, I will get an output operator that is not a positive operator, and therefore cannot be a density operator, a legal density operator. And your homework is to try it out. This is really easy. Take a very simple, input state like this one. Try it out. Show that you'll have to, of course, write down the density operator. Show that when I apply the operator to this operator to this input state, I get something that's not a positive operator. Okay. That's the only homework I'm going to give you. Probably. Okay, so great. We know now that any conceivable quantum evolution has to be a linear, trace-preserving, completely positive map. In fact, I've done something wrong here, haven't I? I've called this 4, but really, this is really 3 prime. This is the new version of 3. Having it be positive is not a separate condition. That's subsumed in the condition of being completely positive. Yes?
Excuse me, I didn't understand your argument about linearity. Initially, we have no assumption about the time evolution of system.
Well, we have an assumption about the time evolution, which is, it's a hidden assumption, but it's an assumption. It is that the time evolution is a map on density operators. So that if I tell you the initial density operator for the system, then that will tell me the final density operator for the system.
Yeah,
that's my assumption.
it's not trivial assumption. I mean,
no, it's not. Of course, there are plenty of
options. It's obvious that if two systems are described by the same density operator at this moment, they will be described by the same density operator later.
If they are subject to the same external conditions, is it not obvious? Or is it not probable? Or is it not? I mean, like I say, this is one of these cases where I'm trying to take physical considerations and derive mathematical statements, and Einstein's famous victim about mathematics being certain in as much as it doesn't refer to reality and being uncertain as much as it does. Or something like that. I'm not saying it. He said it much more elegantly. That certainly applies here, but there is one, there are certainly situations where two states with initial density operators might wind up in different situations. For example, those density operators could arise by entanglement with some other system with which they later interact. And so one of them happens to be at 0, 0, plus 1, 1, and the other one at 0, 0, minus 1, 1, and that leads to quite different results. Okay? In that case, that's quite right. That would not be described by a map such as I'm talking about. But in fact, that's not described by a map on density operators alone, because only knowing the density operator of the system is insufficient to predict the future behavior of the system. So what I'm looking for is descriptions of dynamics of a certain sort, where the future state of a system, which is a subsystem of the whole universe, can be predicted from the past state of that subsystem. And that's a special case. There will be other things where there are correlations, pre-existing correlations with the universe that will be very important, but I can't describe that in this way.
I think to deduce the formalism of density operator from a state vector, you need linearity of time evolution to show that.
The density operator of formalism from state vectors?
Yeah.
This sort of thing where I imagine ensembles and average values and predict probabilities and expectations, that doesn't work.
Yeah, but this fact that two systems have the same density operator now will have the same density operator later. It's a result of linearity.
It's a result of linearity, or it can be. The result of linearity. You can derive it from linearity, I suppose, but I guess we like unitary evolution of the whole universe.
I mean, you have assumed linearity in that relation.
It's linear, but I have linearity here in the density operator. Linearity in the state vector is nowhere present. Which linearity are you talking about? You're talking about linearity
of time evolution.
Wait, that's not good enough. Because this right here is a linear operator. This is an element of the set of operators on the Hilbert space. But this is a linear map on an operator. So it's an element of the set of operators on the set of operators on the Hilbert space. So these guys are completely different sorts of things. Which linearity do you mean?
For example, this fact that U is linear, time evolution is linear, is necessary to.
I'm not assuming that there is any unitary transformation sitting around. I'm not assuming that exists. I'm simply assuming that there exists a map on density operators. That if you give me the density operator of the system, then the dynamics functions in such a way that I can predict the density operator of the system at a later time. Yes, same question.
You do assume implicitly that if you have two different density matrices, two density matrices that are the same now, they will remain identical in the future.
Yes, that's what I just said. Yes, that's an assumption.
Instead of doing that assumption, you would have taken the assumption that the evolution of pure states is unitary, and then this would have followed.
It would have followed.
Depending on where you want to start.
But that was a pure state unitary. But this might be totally non-unitary. This might not pure states to mixed states to pure states, have all kinds of things that might happen.
And then you need
randomized
the whole system and then...
Oh, well, we're getting there, yeah.
So the point is, you can start either from here or from there.
You can start with an assumption about the entire universe. But I'm starting from an assumption about the little system. Then later on, maybe I'll make it happen about the universe. But for now, we're going to talk about the we're going to talk about the system. We're just taking it as a hypothesis that there are systems that are sort of like this. If I have kind of a quantum description of the input, I get a quantum description of the output. There may be a whole lot going on in the rest of the universe, but I hope I don't have to solve the Schrodinger equation for the whole universe in order to make predictions. Because otherwise, I won't make any predictions. And that's a very deep point, and we'll come up again in a second. I'm assuming that there is that the time evolution is represented by a map on density operators, which means that if you on Tuesday did this process with this density operator and got that, then me on Wednesday. Doing the same process with this density operator would also get the same density operator out. But are there more things that could happen? Yeah, we got to classify all of these guys because all the others are not maps on density operators. There's something else. I'm going to call things that are trace-preserving, linear, completely positive maps, something a little shorter. I'm going to just call them CP maps. That stands for completely positive because that's the condition that's really interesting. I think the linearity and the trace-preserving meaningness we'll just take that as a given. These are CP maps. So we've argued that Any sort of evolution described by a map on quantum states has got to be a CP map. That raises the question. Is it true that every CP map is an imaginable evolution, or is there some additional restriction that nature imposes? It's not just the CP maps, it's the CP maps that are purple. And that stands for some mathematical problem. What's next? And or is it the case that given a CP map E, can we figure out a way that could happen quantum mechanically in a non-controversial fashion? And the answer to the second question is yes. We can physically realize any CP map in a certain sense, as you will see. And why don't you see now? Why there? Okay. Here's the theorem. Given any CP map E, for system Q, we can find, asterisk, I'll tell you what I mean by find in a moment, we can find, and we'll call it an environment system, E and a unitary interaction U between the two so that E of rho any Q state rho, E of rho is simply equal to, let's see, I think rho. And I take the product state between rho and some standard state of the environment. Then I act on that joint state with u. Then I take the partial trace over E. In other words, I can always make E by appending system E in the some standard state zero, evolving by unitary operation, the unitary transformation U, and discarding the environment. So this is really a big and important theorem. This says that any map on density operators that meets a kind of a minimal set of requirements for making sense as dynamics of a system, in fact, could be realized by unitary dynamics on a larger system, which starts out with no correlations between my system of interest and the environment. When I say fine here, means mathematical. That I'm not making any. I'm not making any assertion that this is really what happens. Okay, maybe the universe has things that aren't things that just aren't unitary in any sense. But any CP map has a mathematical representation like this. We could tell ourselves a story about an environment and an interaction, a unitary interaction that would account for this particular map on density operators. Yes?
There are also, we can realize physically maps which are positive and not completely positive. So are you missing, I mean, like Pichu, Cass, and recently Daniel Tenno and Thomas Jorg, you know.
Let's be careful here. Are they trace preserving also? No, because they are selective operations. You see, imagine you made a measurement, okay? This is a kind of operation, an ideal measurement with a projection postulate. The operation that I'm talking about is not projecting onto one of the outcomes. The operation I'm talking about is projecting onto the probabilistic mixture of all of the outcomes. It's not conditional on any information. You can do other things, but we're not doing any conditional stuff. Also, there's something else wrong with that. What was that? You can do an operation which appears to be a mixture of the identity and the transpose, but that mixture is not CP, even though the transpose here, the reflection, is not. Am I wrong?
I don't know.
Oh. I don't know either. I don't think I'm wrong.
It has to be positive, even if it's non-trace preserving.
That's also right. That's also right. Yeah, that's true.
Same reason.
That's true.
And you know, if you substitute the tensor product there with an entangled state, such that when the first system is raw, then you realize.
And that's not yes, but that means that. That means that evolution is no longer a map on the density operator for the system, because different entangled states would evolve differently. So the primary assumption is that our evolution is described by a map on quantum states of the system, that in order to predict the quantum state, even the bit state, of the system later, it suffices to know the quantum state of the system earlier. So these are obviously, if there is pre-existing interactions, anything can happen. But it's no longer a map on quantum states. of the system.
It can be a partial, oh, okay, we leave this.
Okay. So what I want to tell you is how this proof works. And it's actually kind of cute. This is a cool theorem. I think it's an important enough theorem in thinking about the foundations of quantum mechanics that it's worth talking about. Let me just mention. You've seen that any mixed state can be thought of as a subsystem state for an entangled system. That there's really a pure state of a larger system. And we're just seeing part of that, so it seems like a mixed state. And Chris told you just the other day that if you have one of these strange positive operator measurements, you could always think of that as a projection operator measurement on a larger system. As I said, Scylla, you had an interaction, and then you made a measurement, an ideal measurement, on the Scylla system. And this is telling us that any dynamics of this sort can be thought of as unitary dynamics on a larger system. This is what John Smolin, not Lee Smolin, the other Smolin, what John Smolin has christened the Church of a Larger Hilbert Space. In the Church of a Larger Hilbert Space, all states are pure. All measurements are ideal. And all time evolution is unitary. And it's all accomplished by this sort of mathematical purification of everything. And it's a very powerful calculational tool. And if you believe in the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, you believe there's a state vector for the universe and that's what's going on, then you might be tempted to say this is a great tool because it's true. Perhaps you should belong to that particular sect of the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space, or perhaps you should remember Alfred North Whitehead's victim: seek simplicity and distrust it. Use the Everett interpretation and don't believe it. Okay, so all right. So here's our theorem. We want to say how this is proved. We're gonna sort of give a sketch. And I'll try to draw as much as possible rather than doing math. Well, it is math, but it's sort of drawing. So the first thing is to note that I could have my system Q and my system R, and Q is going to be undergoing the evolution here. R is going to be undergoing this trivial evolution, and I'm going to start out with a particular system, a particular state, psi naught. And what is psi naught? Psi naught is a maximally entangled state. R has the same dimension as Q, and it's a maximally entangled state of the two of them. Here's the dimension. Okay, now, a maximally entangled state. Now, if you can imagine doing measurements on R. You can imagine doing a measurement on R and getting some result. And if you do a measurement on R and you get some result, as Chris told you the other day, this is great, this, thank you so much. As Chris told me the other day, you'll get a state. You'll get a state of the other system. You get a measurement on R. You'll get a particular result. You'll get a state, a relative state, an inferred state of Q. So we're going to sort of represent that symbolically. I'm skipping a little bit of the mathematical details. I'm going to imagine a mathematical operation called M. It's going to be M of system R, and it's going to be phi, and that means I make an R measurement and obtain the result phi. And the point is that this operation will turn this state into that particular state of E that I would get. So I'll write that this way, sort of in sort of symbolically, that this guy is actually some state of Q. The point is that a particular state of Q could be realized by an operation that is performed entirely on R, perhaps at a great distance away. It's completely separate. Okay, now, so what I could imagine is that in order to look at the output of E for a system for a particular input state phi, I could take this state, make a measurement on R, if I'm lucky, get the result phi, and then allow the joint system to evolve. Okay, so let's represent that. So what do? I start out with phi naught. And I make this measurement on R, and I'm lucky enough to get the result phi, and I get this state for phi, and then I act on it with E, which of course only affects the system Q, so I'll remind you of that by writing EQ right here, and that will give me the output state E of phi. And I could do this because there's a measurement and a result that will give me any state at all. I could do this for any such state. But notice that this is something that happens on R, physically happens on R, and this is something that physically happens on Q. So these two processes, if you will, these two processes commute. And I'm not going to show this. It's easy enough to show analytically, and you can think that as your second order problem if you like. It's easy enough to show that if I first evolve the joint system by I tensor EQ, then I'll get I tensor EQ of the original joint system psi naught, and then I perform this measurement and happen to get this result on R. I'll wind up with the same thing. In other words, I can first do the dynamics and then pick which state I put into the dynamics. I'm not really picking because I'm sort of relying on chance to come up with a result, but it doesn't matter because these things are operations that really physically occur completely differently, and it doesn't matter which one happens first. It doesn't matter which one happens first. So that's kind of cool. We're going to do the dynamics first, then pick the input Q state. Now, I know that this state right here, is a good density operator because my map is CP. Okay? It's a good density operator, so I'll call it something. I'll call it omega. I'll say omega RQ just to be definite. Okay? Omega RQ is a density operator in a D squared dimensional Hilbert space. Now, because of the density operator, I know that there could be a larger system containing RQ and some other system, which is in a pure state. And the subsystem state for RQ is omega RQ. So I can append a system, I'll call it E. And by the way, it needs to have a Hilbert space no bigger than dimension B squared. And then I'll have a state, I call this phi, I guess. Phi, capital phi. which is a state that's a state of RQ and E. And if I take the trace over E of that density operator, I'll get the possibly mixed density operator omega RQ. Yes?
When you say do the genetics first and then pick out your state, does that mean that first you do that, i.e. the operation, then you do the makeup?
Correct. Because those two things happen on different different systems, and the time order of them doesn't matter. And I'm using that physical argument as a shortcut for a sort of a simple mathematical. But not particularly fascinating mathematical argument. Okay, now this is kind of cool. I want you to notice something about this state. I want you to notice that this state, if I were to take the trace over E and Q, I get a density operator over R. Which density operator would I get? Well, nothing has happened to R, so it should be the density operator I started out with, right? Which is, in fact, completely mixed. It's 1 over D times the identity. That's the density operator for R. It's the density operator that I had to begin with for R. It's the density operator that I had at the end for R. And what can we say about those two? What can I say about that? Well, I can say that, I'll say it this way. If I have a density operator and I extend it to a larger system and have a pure state of the whole thing, that's called a purification of this density. And I can do that in many different ways. But any two purifications for this density operator are related by a unitary transformation on the extending system, not affecting the original system. Applying that here, I can start out with a state that's psi naught for RQ and zero for E. This is one purification for the R state. And then this other one is another purification for R state. This is an RQ state, that's an E state. This is an RQE state. These are both purifications for the same R system, the same R state. Therefore, they're related by a unitary transformation. So, saying that, so that tells me that phi is equal to U, which only acts on Q and E, of psi naught tensor zero. Okay. Now comes the beautiful part. The operation, and I've got one more diagram to draw. Okay, good. All right. Remember this operation? I said this operation commuted with this dynamics. Okay? With this dynamics. It also commutes with anything that happens just on Q and E. It commutes with this unitary operator as an operation on density operator. It commutes with the partial trace over the environment. If I wanted to take a partial trace over the environment, I could do it before, I could do it after, it wouldn't matter what I did with respect to this operation. So I'm going to draw the picture that will tell you everything. And then we'll go through it. The first, save the big board for the picture. Okay, here's the picture of the proof. But the first part is sort of like what we had before. I start out with this state now. This, of course, is an RQ state, and this, of course, is an E state right here. That's what I start out with. And then I could evolve this by this U of QE. And if I did that, as I said before, I get the state capital phi. That's an RQE state. Or I could imagine that let me make this a larger arrow. That I did this measurement on R and got the result phi, in which case I'd wind up with a state little phi, 0, this being a Q state, and this being an E state. And then I can operate on this with U, Q, E, and I get, what would I get? I get U, I get that thing, phi tensor 0, dagger. And since this QE operation must commute on physical grounds with this R operation, then this would give me this if I did that operation on this state of RQE. Furthermore, if I then take the trace over the environment for this guy, I'll get the state omega RQ. Omega RQ, which was this guy. That's the I tensor E times that initial thing. And if I were to do my trick of making a measurement on R and being lucky enough to get the outcome phi, well, I already argued that that would give me E of phi. That would give me of the output for this pure state input of the operation. But everything in this diagram is. So, if I take the trace over the environment of this state, I must get this state. Therefore, E of the pure state input is the trace over the environment of U phi tensor 0 U dagger. And of course, if I proved it for all pure states, I've proved it for all the mixtures of pure states, because this is clearly a linear in the operator, in this operator, so it'll be true also for mixtures. Okay. This is a very powerful theorem. And when we come back from P, we'll see where it takes us.